Okay, so like I was saying, there initially were 4 complainants, but now there's 5 that are actually working on this complaint. We all met at Osgood, and we decided in our 3rd year, well, for 3 of us, it was our 3rd year, for 2 of the complainants, it was in 1st year and 2nd year, that we wanted to look at publications in the media that we felt defamed and targeted minority groups. And we didn't want to look at these sort of publications just from a legal standpoint, we just wanted to look to see if there was an appropriate balance within the media. So the article in question, as was mentioned, it was called The Future Belongs to Islam, published in October 2006 in Complaints Magazine. The article is actually an excerpt from Mark Stein's book titled America Alone. Not sure how many of you are familiar with that book. So we read the article when it was published, and we basically found, or our position was that we did in fact, there was very strong evidence that the article did promote hatred. Just to tie this into some recent events, the article was the subject of a Western Standard blog, for which the owner of the Western Standard, Matthew Johnson, has apologized to the Muslim community, and the story was covered by the Calgary Herald. So the comments, when I say promote hatred, some of the comments, for instance, were, I mean, I've just got a couple of them, there's no such thing as innocent Muslims, and they must all be killed. So the article spoke about Muslims in general as a threat to Western society, and the constant theme in the article was that the West should be scared of Muslims because, you know, they're growing in numbers. We decided very early on that this type of speech is very dangerous if these sort of allegations are not rebutted, essentially. Now, I won't take, now you guys are all familiar to go ahead and read the article, but I'm just going to draw your attention very quickly to one excerpt. It's also in this report that we handed out. So for instance, Mark Stein states, time for the obligatory of course. Of course, not all Muslims are terrorists, although enough of them are hot for jihad to provide an impressive support network of mosques from Vienna to Stockholm to Toronto to Seattle. Of course, not all Muslims support terrorists, though enough of them share their basic objectives. So, as you can see, very problematic. No one's contesting the fact that McLean's has a right to publish what they want. I mean, they can continue to publish these sort of provocative articles if they wish, but the issue is about the right of communities to participate in our national dialogue on issues that relate to them especially. And in light of the fact that McLean's is Canada's leading national news magazine, it has a social responsibility. And McLean's and other magazines, for instance, claim that they publish what they published in the public interest, but the public interest lies in hearing a debate on these sort of controversial issues. Sorry, just give me 1 second. So for instance, it's not just the fact that McLean's published this one specific article. The first thing we did was we did a case study. So it's really important for me to fill you in on what happened from the time that we actually read the article, from the time that the complaint was actually filed. There has been a lot of attention in the media focused on, well, you know, these lawsuits have sat around for 5 months, like what did they do during these 5 months? So first and foremost, we did a detailed study of the articles that McLean published between January of 2005 and July of 2007. So that's the report that was handed out earlier. And we wanted to get an idea of whether there were any rebuttal pieces or any pieces in general that challenged Stein's point of view from anyone inside or outside the Muslim community. Once we conducted our study, as you'll see from our report, we found that there were at least 19 other articles with similar content, and there was not a single counter-view article published within that period. So we decided as a group at that point that there's something that should be done about this, and it's something essentially that should be troubling to all minority groups. In short, a group was being targeted, serious allegations were being made, and McLean's readership wasn't able to see the opposite side. They were deprived from seeing a healthy debate on, again, as I mentioned, a very controversial issue. So at this point, what we did is we circulated the article to as many people as we could to try to get an idea of what they thought. The article went out to friends, family, students we met when we were in our undergraduate studies, other law students. We posted the article on Facebook, showed it to our law professors, our employers, and the general consensus was that the article definitely was problematic. I mean, the comments range from the article's alarmist to the article promotes hatred. So after our next step was to do some general research just to, you know, see what sort of avenues were available to us, like where we could go from here. And our next step was to meet with McLean's. So it took us about a month to set the meeting up with McLean's, and we met with two editors, two of their editors, senior editor, junior editor, and their counsel. And again, in the media, there's been a lot of attention on what actually transpired during this meeting, so I want to give you guys a good idea as to what exactly took place. We wanted discussion with McLean's. We wanted to sit down and share their concerns, share our concerns with them. We wanted to talk about a resolution. We wanted to propose that they publish another article rebutting some of Stein's factual assertions by an author that would be mutually agreed upon by both parties from either inside or outside the Muslim community. So there was very little dialogue from McLean's, and we asked them to care about our concerns. We accepted them to, again, come to attempt to come to some sort of resolution with us. But this senior editor stated word for word at the meeting that he would rather McLean's go bankrupt than publish a response. So meeting was pretty much over after that. There's been a lot of inaccuracies in the media about what transpired. For instance, the editor has gone on the record, it was on the McLean's website, that we had asked that the article be published by an author of our choice. Or sorry, we demanded that the article be published by an author of our choice. The article had to be 5 pages in length, and we wanted complete and utter fabrications. None of this took place. We then decided to file the human rights complaint because our position was that a minority community had been shut out by McLean's, and we had the right to bring the conduct, bring McLean's conduct essentially to Canadians in general. We also chose to file the complaints because there wasn't any other route for us. I mean, we would have preferred to take the matter to some sort of self-regulatory body of the media, such as a press council, but McLean's doesn't subscribe to one, or it doesn't provide alternative venues for complainants, like an unbiased person or anything of that nature. So we filed with the commissions, the human rights complaint was, so essentially our complaint was prompted by two things: the defamatory content of the article, plus McLean's stifling debate on the issue.
Sorry, I'm just used to standing and talking. I want to point out, Maniza has talked to some degree about, Maniza has talked to some degree about, you know, like the content, like the report itself, and I really want to direct you, because it's not just that they published this one article. Like, there is actually a trend here, and, you know, like this report that we've given out, there's one article here, which is titled, you know, it's by Mark Stein, and he's looking for, okay, well, let me talk about this first one, because we're all familiar with it. This is the little mosque that's written on page 42. Okay, it's about the CBC sitcom, Little Mosque on the Prairie. And the theme of this article is that this CBC sitcom is part of a Muslim conspiracy to make Islam acceptable in Western societies, just like homosexuality. Now, these aren't my words, these are Mark Stein's words, okay? And in there, what he basically says is that there is really nothing such as funny Muslims. In fact, funny Muslims are so non-existent that they had to find non-Muslims to play the roles of funny Muslims in this sitcom, okay? And further, he goes on to say that real Muslims crack jokes about 9/11, about drinking the blood of non-Muslims, etc., etc. There's actually, you know, like, a part in there. And the extract that he takes is off some British comic, okay, who most Muslim Canadians have never heard of, Umar Brooks, to convey the impression that all Muslims at large engage in insensitive jokes about 9/11, because apparently this guy said that, you know, the house really came down on the people who were inside the World Trade Center on those unfortunate days. So that's one example about how apparently the sitcom is part of the Muslim conspiracy. There's another one on page 32, and this one really sticks out in my mind for some reason. It's called Celebrate Tolerance or You're Dead. Oriana Palazzi appeals to Europe to save itself. Good luck. The theme of this article, he basically focuses on this woman, Oriana Palazzi. I don't know how many of you know about her, but According to Mr. Stein himself, she's had to leave Europe because she's wanted on warrants for promoting hatred against European Muslims and Arabs in those countries, and she's now in New York. So he reviews her work, and he describes it, and she says that she's casting what he calls magnificent screeds on how Europe can save itself from the Muslim and Arab takeover. And then he reviews her work. And there's a representation in here, and I'm going to take you into there in a minute, which basically says that Muslims commonly engage in sex with minors and animals, okay? And you know, like, it's all in here, you know, like, there's that's page 432 of our report, and that, in fact, when the Muslim takeover of Europe occurs, they will sodomize European men, you know? That, you know, this kind of material is being published. So my point is that I think that it's important for you to know that so that you're able to contextualize this issue. You know, so this is a pattern. These are 19 articles that have been published in a 2.5-year period without a single contributor. So I hope that that just contextualizes some of our concerns for you, really, because it's not just like minor allegations being made. And you know, Muniza drew your attention to the fact that this guy says that Muslims share the basic objectives of terrorists. Let's just focus on this one statement, because the fact of the matter is that terrorism, and you know, we've heard the statement that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, okay? Whatever the merits of that view are, we can all agree, I think, that terrorism is usually about the means you adopt to attain political goals, okay? So, terrorism actually has nothing to do with objectives. So, because if I was to apply Mark Stein's logic, I could say that the 20% of the Canadian population that votes for the NDP at the next election because they want to bring our troops home from Afghanistan share the same basic objectives of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. No one in their right mind would say that, you know? So that's just my point about, you know, like, I mean, what our concerns are. Now, moving on, you know, Muniza talked about the fact that we filed the complaints. What has happened since we filed these complaints? We've seen a media campaign by McLean's and what I refer to as its supporters or fellow ideologues, because you know what, Mark Stein is hardly the only guy who's engaged in this kind of journalism about the Muslim community. We've seen a distortion of the facts. You know, as Muniza pointed out, we never asked them for money to give us money. We never asked for a 5-page article, none of that. The dude said, point blank, our magazine would rather go bankrupt than publish a response. But for some reason, he doesn't have the courage to say it to the Canadian public. Say it as it is, you know? But for some reason, they don't want to do that. There's been a distortion of the basis of our complaints, that we're trying to shut up, you know, like, that we're trying to stifle free speech. Actually, this should be really liberating, because we've said we're not going to file hate speech complaints against you. Right that we're all terrorists, right that we're all extremists, that we want to have sex with animals and minors, but we want to be able to respond. Not on every occasion, but on some of them. Okay? And if you're not, then in our view, you're motivated by an anti-Muslim agenda, and we reserve the right to inform the Canadian public about that, because presumably, the Canadian public wants to know why you're publishing this, and why you refuse to let the community in question that you're writing about actually publish a response once in a while. So, that's the point. There have been personal attacks on us, there have been personal attacks on Dr. Al-Masri, who's the president of the Canadian Islamic Congress, you know, trying to make this an event about a particular individual's political baggage from the past, when in fact it is clear from the media coverage, okay, and it will, you know, soon become clear, hopefully, when we announce our coalition around this issue, that this isn't an issue that just affects the Muslim community. You know, there are plenty of communities that are affected by this. And one thing that sticks in my mind, where I work, I'm an Arlington Law student, and I remember that a couple of months ago, the Toronto Star ran a story about where are the men or something like that. And this was about single mothers in Toronto, okay? And one of my colleagues who I work with, who happens to be, you know, African-Canadian, black man, he said to me, look at how on the front page of the Toronto Star, when they were talking about single mothers, the person that they had to put was a black mom. As if, I mean, it's hardly a problem that's reserved to the black community, you know, single mothers and you know, the fact that, and the hardships that life as a single parent creates for them. My point is that this is an issue that affects the Aboriginal community, the Chinese community, the African-Canadian community, and in fact, all Canadians, because in our view, all Canadians lose when they don't get to hear from the community that has a direct stake in the issue. So, the point is that this is an issue that's broader than just the Muslim community in our view. Now, despite all these attacks, we've been able to get our point of view out there. We've had our opinion editorials published in the National Post, in the Calgary Herald, in the London Free Press. We've had letters to the editor published in the Ottawa Citizen. There have been articles even written in the Washington Times about these complaints, right? And the issue really is, as Muniza pointed out, is about the right of communities to participate in our national dialogue on issues that relate directly to them. That's what the issue is. This issue isn't necessarily about the balance between free speech and hate speech and where does free speech and in hate speech begin. So that's some of the things that I wanted to point out to you. What we have started doing is, and I really want to thank, you know, like two organizations in particular who are represented here today, Canadian Arab Federation, the Canadian Federation of Students, who, you know, helped us in making this event possible, and of course the Rising Students Union. You know, we are going to build a coalition around this issue, and they have really helped us. You know, people who just came to us on their own because they felt that there was an issue of basic equity here that needed to be addressed. So we're going to form a coalition around three issues: the right of communities to respond to defamatory publications. Okay. Two is the right to pursue remedies under the human rights codes themselves, and three, to protect the human rights commissions. Why these last two items? It's incredible that when the Muslim community, and this just shows the kind of climate that has been built up by this kind of media representation of Muslims. You know, we're hardly the first community that has taken a media organization to the Human Rights Commission, believe it or not. But I'm sure that this is the first time that most of you have heard about it. You know, not only are we being attacked, the Human Rights Commission itself is being attacked. Like articles that, you know, shut down the Human Rights Commissions, do this, that they're kangaroo courts, like a full frontal attack on the Human Rights Commission, which, by the way, whether we realize it or not, protects the interests of about 90% of Canadians out there, as employees, as persons with disabilities, as visible minorities, as women. Okay, so it's not just the South Asian community, the Pakistani community, or visible minorities, or, you know, a narrow group of people out there who rely on it. I worked at Parkdale, and most of my clients there were women who hadn't been accommodated in the workplace with respect to pregnancy. Okay? So I want to point that out to you, that it's really, really important to speak on behalf of these commissions, because they can't speak on themselves, on their own behalf. And we're seeing a lot of equity-seeking groups and just, you know, social justice groups coming to support us on this. So that's the basis of our coalition. That's what we want to accomplish. And again, before I leave, I just want to remind you that to us, this is what this issue is about the right of stakeholders and communities to participate in the national debate on the issues that relate directly to them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Khalid Lutfi Moyamar, who has over 30 years of volunteer experience with organizations including the Arab-Palestine Association, the Arab Community Centre of Toronto, Urban Alliance on Race Relations, Canadian Ethnocultural Council, Ontario Committee for Fairness in Policing, and the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid. Khalid has received several awards and recognitions, including Volunteer Service Award from Ontario Ministry of Citizenship and Culture, the Queen's Silver Jubilee Award from the Governor General of Canada, and a certificate of recognition from the Citizens Forum on Canada's Future. Khalid has served as a board member for the Immigration and Refugee Board from 1994 to 2005, adjudicating on refugee claims. He currently serves as the National President of the Canadian Arab Federation and works as a consultant with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. Khalid holds a Master's in Business Administration from the University of Toronto, a Bachelor of Science degree in Mathematics, and a Diploma in Education from American University of Beirut. He's also fluent in Arabic and Portuguese. Please help me welcome Khalid.
So it's not really an ivory tower, academic exercise when we discuss this, this issue, because it's an issue that affects the well-being of all racialized groups, specifically those who are of Muslim and Arab background, and who want to live in dignity and who are living in this country. That's why many of them immigrated to this country, to live in dignity and to earn a decent living. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states, it's true that everyone has a freedom of speech and expression, but that should not impinge on the freedoms and rights of others, and it should not result in a public disorder affecting the welfare of these other groups. The media in Canada has intentionally or unintentionally spread racism against Muslims and Arabs by stereotyping them, presenting them as a menace, as terrorists, as shadowy figures who do not operate within the Canadian value system, and therefore they should be feared and mistrusted. This depiction of Muslims and Arabs is nothing new, but it promotes the demonization of these groups, and at the same time, it makes other Canadians view them as less than human. And it is really a transference of the anti-Semitic hatred against Jews from Jews to Muslims. Basically, this is the attempt that's being done by people like Mark Stein, Ezra Levant, and others. In Nazi Germany, Jews were associated with capitalist greed. They were promoting international anarchy and communism. And now we have the Muslim and the Arab as retrogressive, he has no morals, greedy, and they are architects of international terrorism. So there is a similarity in this approach used by the media in Nazi Germany and in Canada. In Nazi Germany, this depiction of the Jews started in the 20s, and it took 15 to 20 years before it had its effect. So this is why it's very important to stop the promotion of these stereotypes against Muslims and Arabs. I.F. Stone, who is an American Jew, states that every war, every outburst of genocide is prepared by the propaganda which paints the victim, the other, as less than human. This is the ultimate lesson of Auschwitz. He who treats his brother as less than equal prepares the path to the furnace. And how has this stereotyping and dehumanization of Muslims and Arabs affected them? There were various studies that have appeared in the last 2 years, and I will quote them, which are basically stating that the media coverage and international events which are happening are shaping the views of our neighbors, that we have of our neighbors in Canada. The Ipsos Reid poll, which was conducted in March 2005, shows that Canadians believe that the following groups are most targeted by racism. 38% think that Muslims and Arabs are the ones who are targeted most. 31% think it's Aboriginals and First Nations. And 28% think it's Blacks. And 17% of those who were interviewed in this study believe that racism was on the rise. This is in 2005. Sun Media poll of January 2007 says that 47% of Canadians harbor prejudice against Arab Canadians. A Canadian Labour Congress study of February 2006 shows that Canadian-born visible minorities face the highest barriers to steady well-paying jobs, and that the unemployment rate is high, and I'll give you for the following groups, for the Arabs and West Asians, which are basically Muslim countries, you know, we're looking at Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the unemployment rate is 14%. The next group is Blacks at 11.5%, which was surprising in my case. I thought, you know, Blacks were facing more problems than employment. And that it says that this inequality in the workplace is not based on education or qualifications, because these minority groups have good education. At the same time, it shows that the earning gap is widening in the last 5 years. York University study in March of 2006 says that poverty in Toronto is highly racialized.
and that the economic gap between European and non-European ethno-culture, ethno-racial groups has been increasing. It states that 40% of African ethno-racial group members live below the poverty level. 30% of Arab and West Asian group members live below the poverty level, compared to 10% for European groups. So this is affecting also poverty. A study conducted by the Canadian Federation of Students in March 2007 found that Muslim students daily face both overt and subtle forms of Islamophobic discrimination on Ontario campuses. A Muslim chaplain, I was told that the Muslim chaplain who goes to the West Toronto Detention Center is ready to quit because of the harassment and discrimination that he faces and that he sees being faced by Muslim inmates. On Ramadan, when other religious inmates have their religious holidays, they are given 1 hour for meals and prayers. He was told he had only 20 minutes. So he went in there with the food and he told the inmates, "Do you want to pray or to eat?" They were religious, so they said, "We will pray first and then we'll try to eat." When they finished praying, they just had 5 minutes. And when they were starting to eat, the guard came and said, "That's it." And he took them all back. Most of them did not eat. So this is going on in all aspects. University of Toronto study of January 2007 found that ethno-racial immigrants are slower to integrate into Canadian society than their white counterparts, and they feel less Canadian because of that. So children, and the more stranger part is this, that children of ethnocultural immigrants exhibited a more profound sense of exclusion than their parents. So the children who are born here find more alienation than their parents. Integration is impeded by perception of discrimination and vulnerability. 35% of ethno-racial immigrants experience discrimination compared to 19% for whites. 42% of the children of these ethno-racial immigrants experience discrimination. So the children experience more discrimination than their parents. I think they had a higher expectation than their parents. I'm sure when I came here, my daughter who was born here has a higher expectation. She thinks I am full Canadian. And then in real life, she finds that that's not happening in practice, and therefore the disenchantment is higher. In conclusion, therefore, media coverage is responsible largely for the dehumanization and marginalization of ethno-racial groups generally, and specifically Muslim and Arab groups. And this is important because, you know, multiculturalism was supposed to make people feel welcome in this country and to integrate them. But when there is discrimination, this impedes this process because people know that they're not being respected and accepted into Canadian society. And this is why we have a rise in racism against groups, generally all ethno-racial groups, and specifically Muslim and Arabs. And this is why we have discrimination in employment, education, and this is why we have a rise in unemployment and poverty. Now, this does not only affect racialized groups. A society cannot prosper and progress if you have tension within the society. If you have a substantial minority, in the GTA area, you have 50% of the population are now from racialized groups. If you have this substantial minority feeling that they are not wanted, they're alienated, they're marginalized, how can you expect them to be loyal to the country and participate and produce for the betterment of their country? Canada, therefore, is not immune from what happened in France unless we stop this. We stop this maligning, defamation, dehumanization of racialized groups, all racialized groups, specifically Muslims and Arabs, because if we don't, we will end up with a social division, we will end up with social problems, and we will have the riots that happened in France in June of 2005. So this is an issue for all Canadians, not only racialized groups. It's for every Canadian who believes that this country should be based on equality of all races and religions of all communities, and that there is no room for discrimination, for bigots who are trying to import into this country ideas which are contrary to Canadian values, to international law, and to human values. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So our fourth speaker is Rebecca Rose. Rebecca is a fourth-year journalism student whose passion for human rights and fair journalism